said again, welcome. This is the section on IP basics. This, I guess you'd call it a lecture, is kind of designed for people who are trying to protect their intellectual property as opposed to some of the discussions we've been having yesterday as far as people trying to get around IP protection. Let's see. All right, so about me. I'm an entertainment IP lawyer. I do about probably 50% entertainment, about 50% just general IP. I work with, well, for one thing, I work with Frescona Courtney. It's a law firm in Jackson, Mississippi. And they really specialize in entertainment, and then I'm kind of branching off into more dealing with inventions and the patent realm, and then trademark and that sort of thing. I represent several independent inventors, several artists, both in print media and in music, that sort of thing, several businesses, a couple of independent record labels, gospel mostly. And this card, I have to use him. I love Munchkin. Yeah, he's the lawyer demon, and he's great. Best advice, don't get a fight with a lawyer, because he will take 90% of your assets. All right, so the way this lecture is set up, we're going to talk about protecting a game, although a lot of this would apply to really a lot of different things, whether it's a book or whether, you know, whatever, although that would probably fall more under copyright. We're just going to kind of go down the line and talk about a little bit of everything. We'll start off with patent. Well, and this is going to be our hypothetical game. This is Cattle Racers, a moving experience. Yes, I know it's cheesy, but I'm cheesy, so it's okay. This is our hypothetical game, and let's see. First off, what is a patent? A patent is a right that's granted by the U.S. government, and really the purpose of a patent is to allow the patent holder to prevent others from making, selling, using, or importing the invention. You know, so if someone has a patent and you violate any of those particular things, the patent holder can sue in court and stop that from happening. Now, what needs to be understood is that the sole function of a patent is to give a right to sue. You can invent something, you can use it, you can do whatever you want to with it. You don't have to have a patent. It just helps if you want to prevent other people from copying you. Now, this particular IP right only exists if you have a PTO registration. If you don't file a patent on invention, you can't really do anything with it legally as far as preventing other people from copying. The other issue is you always have to patent an embodiment, not an idea. If you have a concept, this is something I hear a lot from inventors, is I have an idea, I want to protect it. Well, you don't really protect an idea per se, because that's a little broad. If you're going to file for a patent, you have to get very, very specific. This is what I'm protecting. You have to lay that out for the patent examiners, because they don't give broad grants unless you have a very, very good reason for it. Generally. Sometimes you get a new guy, but even with that, their controls are getting better. Typically, if you get a new examiner, he's been in classes, and then he has to be on the phone with a experienced examiner for a while. So there are supposed to be controls in place to prevent just anything getting issued, although sometimes it happens. But anyway, the requirements for something to be patentable, it has to be new, useful, and non-obvious. And that last one especially is kind of a sticky term. For something to be new, patent only goes to the first inventor. Now, that means first inventor anywhere. If someone in India beat you to it and there's some proof that they invented this particular invention first, you can't get a patent on it. The other big issue that most people aren't aware of, and it's very important, especially in this realm, is that if you publicly disclose your item, your invention, you put it out in a magazine, you tell other people about it, or if you sell it, that starts a one-year clock running. At the end of that year, if you have not filed something with the Patent and Trademark Office, you forever lose your rights to file a patent. It goes into the public domain, you're done. Now, obvious examples of, you know, games, since I'm trying to kind of go that direction, that are not new: chess, solitaire, stuff that's been around forever, not new. Typically, where you end up patenting things are patenting new elements to pre-existing technology or improvements or different methods. That's normally how you're going to patent a game or a toy, is you patent it in terms of, well, at least with a game, you're patenting in terms of the method of play. And normally you try to put some claims in both for a method and for the object itself, and you kind of just see what gets through. as far as useful. It's really a question of functionality. Does your invention do anything? And this is a very, very low standard. Games do stuff. I mean, you enjoy them, you know, play with cards, you put rings together, whatever it happens to be. And eventually, you can come up with some kind of argument of why this is useful. The patent doesn't, the patent office doesn't usually inquire very deeply into this. It's a very low standard. Now, the trickiest is non-obvious. This is a very, very subjective question. As far as if something's new, you can just go out and do a patent search. Is something exactly like this? If not, then it's new. With non-obvious, it says, if something's obvious, if I take several pre-existing parts and put them together into a slightly new combination. And it's a question of, is there some kind of teaching in the art that would try to convince me to do that? And again, that's a very subjective question, especially when you're defining what is your art area. And I guess I'm kind of using some term of art there. But like, for instance, in electrical engineering, it would be, what do other electrical engineers do, and would another electrical engineer think, yeah, this is something that would be obvious to try? Same thing with in the game area, is going to be, would other game makers think, yeah, this is just an obvious extension of what we're already doing? As an example, you know, that Star Trek 3D chess that they show in all the Star Trek, and got the different little levels where the chess pieces are moving, that could arguably be obvious because they're just taking a chessboard and moving different to different levels. So it really, this is one of those that depends on what examiner you get, how draconian they're going to be as far as, you know, arguing this particular point. The good thing is games and typically are going to receive less scrutiny. Normally the patent examiners are going to come down really hard on high-tech issues. They want to be very, very careful on whether or not they let those through. With a game, you might be able to slide through with a little less of problems than you would in some other areas. Now, we'll have our cattle racer game just as a hypothetical example of how all this would actually work. Let's say we have some goofy little mechanic of cards flipping as far as in gameplay. And this has probably been done. But just, again, as an example, say you've got some cows and trying to race the finish line, and say you've got some cards in play that affect how the cows are moving. Maybe you swap them around. Maybe you flip them over so that they can't run. Now, this game is definitely useful just because, as I said, the useful bar is very, very low. This may be new, although there are a lot of games that have little tapping mechanics. Magic is the first thing that comes to mind. Now, it's probably not obvious because, or it probably is obvious. And unfortunately, in patent law, for some reason, they like to use double negatives. But it's not non-obvious just because, again, it's a minor alteration on some other mechanics that already exist. And quite frankly, I didn't spend the time to come up with something really unique and revolutionary. But so this one, because it probably fails that non-obvious requirement, it's probably not patentable. But this is a very, very fact-intensive kind of inquiry. Basically, you'd want to look at, if you're going to try to go for a patent on something, you want to do a patent search, you want to look at it and try to figure out, is this something that's likely to be patentable before you even start? Because unfortunately, patent is very expensive. Now, just some examples of some games that have been patented. I've mentioned Magic. They actually patented the method of tapping cards and doing that sort of thing. And it's a pretty long claim. I didn't go through and dissect it point by point, but they always are. Just some other games real quick. And these were just, I pulled some patents off the PTO website. I'm not sure what any of these games are, but it looks like we've got some kind of a tile game up in the upper right-hand corner, and over on the left we've got some kind of fantasy setting, and then down on the right it's some kind of miniatures type game. So there are examples of other people that have patented stuff. Now, the interesting thing is, and one thing I should clarify here, having a patent does not mean success as far as selling a product. Those are two completely different issues, because I am not familiar with any of these things on the screen. They put money into getting a patent. That doesn't mean they managed to actually get in the market and make money on it. They just want to prevent anybody else from competing, but if you don't ever actually get it off the ground, that's not an issue anyway. So why would you want to get a patent? First thing is, you want to prevent any copycats. You want to prevent somebody taking your game mechanic and just making an exact copy of it. Also, it gives you kind of a competitive advantage for that reason. And just marketing people like the word patent. I don't know why, but there's just this idea that it's, there's something special about it. This is our patented product or whatever. So those are all kind of things to consider. Now, the first thing, if you want to actually go for this, you got to file a patent with the USPTO. That's United States Patent and Trademark Office. I'll just refer to them as PTO because anytime I use that, I talk about them a lot. But typically, it's not something you'd want to draft on your own. These things are very, very specific. And unfortunately, they're rather expensive because they all have to be very, very tailored to whatever project you're working on. There are no forms for a patent, as an example. You can try to build a form, but it doesn't really do what it's supposed to do, and it's going to have issues when it gets to the examiner anyway. And that goes to the, must be in the proper format. The other issue is it takes forever to get a patent. You file your application, you're going to be waiting 4 or 5 years to get a first response from the office action. It'll get put in queue, and it'll be assigned to the right art group. And really, I think what it comes down to is the patent office, the number of patents have been steadily increasing almost logarithmically over the last 10 years or so. And the patent office really hasn't been hiring that many new examiners, so they're just backlogged. And it's steadily getting worse. Exactly. Because whenever you file that patent application, as soon as you submit it to them, and currently you do that electronically, as soon as you hit that submit button, it is pending their review. And that pending status will last until it's either finally issued or finally rejected. And that's normally what I advise people to do is, you know, keep your invention secret because of that 1 year clock issue I was talking about earlier until you file it. Once you file the patent, patent application, just go on and do what you're going to do. Try to make some money off of it because you really can't wait around for, you know, 4 or 5 years for the patent office to get around to dealing with you. So anyway, you go through their system and, you know, they have fees and that sort of thing. Interestingly enough, or at least I think it's interesting because I'm a big dork, the patent office is one of those government entities that doesn't make any money off of taxes. They make all their money off of fees. And then actually they turn around and take some of that their money and it goes into the general fund. So the point of that being that you can do almost anything you want with the PTO as long as you pay a fee. Every time you turn around, they'll hit you with another one, and they can rack up pretty quick. So, yes, ma'am?
At what point are you actually...
As far as actual protection that you could go in court and use, the way that works is once the patent issues, it's retroactive to the date you file. So that leaves an interesting little problem because, A, anyone who comes in and starts making a project similar to yours during that patent pending time, you can't really do anything about them right then other than write them nasty letters and tell them, I'm going to sue you in 4 or 5 years when this issues. So it's not a whole lot of help at that point, but it's also kind of scary from their side because I've been on both sides of this. And I had an inventor the other day, actually it was about a month or two ago. She had a project she wanted to file a patent on. We went out there and found somebody already had a patent pending on something that was almost identical. And currently it's in their system. It's gone through a couple of different reviews, and we really don't know if it's going to issue or not. So all I could tell her is, if it issues, you're infringing and you're going to be in trouble. If it doesn't issue, you're fine and you can do whatever you want to. So it's kind of causing her problems because she doesn't know whether or not to go forward. So that's one of the benefits, I guess, if you're the one filing, is it does create a lot of uncertainty for everybody else too. But, you know, the downside is there's nothing you can actually do until that issues. And sir, I believe you have a question.
Same question.
Okay. The question back there.
Does a rejection count as prior art? So somebody else's rejection, you're saying, it's very similar. Can that come up to haunt you later in your process?
Well, it depends on what you mean by rejection. Basically, what they look at, and as a practical matter, what the PTO looks at when they do their searches, is they go through and they look through their database of all the issued patents, all the patent applications, and then sometimes they'll do a Google search. If something was rejected over, say, it not working, then it wouldn't be prior art. If it was rejected because there was more prior art to cause that rejection, then yes, it probably would. Yes, sir.
I don't need that. I'll use my theater voice.
For the recording.
Oh, okay. As far as the fees are concerned, is this something that if it's very labor-intensive for the PTO to do, would it be more expensive? I mean, if there was something very highly technically detail-oriented about this patent and that required lots and lots of research, would that be more expensive than something that required just a regular amount of research?
You know, you would think that, but not really. The way the PTO does their fees is based on, are you a large entity or a small entity? Small entity being any person or any company with less than 500 employees. And they strictly base their fees off of that distinction. Now, as far as labor intensive, if it requires, if they examine it, they reject it, then, and say, if I'm, you know, the patent attorney in that case, and I'm kind of against the PTO, if I turn around and argue with them, they reject me again, and we do a lot of back and forth and back and forth, then they issue a final rejection, I can go back and ask again, and the more times I keep coming back, that's when the fees start piling up. That's the labor intensive part. Yes, sir.
Yeah, are there any statistics on how often this process actually succeeds? I mean, in terms of like people doing suits against patent infringers, if it drags on and stuff like that, anyone kept any stats on that?
There have been lots of stats kept. I guess the first question is, do you mean on the issuance rate of patents or do you mean on the success of patent lawsuits?
Patent lawsuits, I guess, is probably
okay.
The...
The thing with patent lawsuits is that they are extremely expensive. Usually, you only really get your big companies that actually run them. The last that I heard, it cost, to run a patent lawsuit, it cost about $5 million a side if you're looking at a big, complicated patent. Unfortunately, because usually the way this game ends up being played in the litigation arena is, say something slips past the examiner, there was some prior art they missed. The first thing that will happen when it comes down to litigation is whoever you sue is going to go back and they're going to do an intensive search, exhaustive, try to find everything under the sun that might count as prior art the examiner might have missed, and they're going to try to knock your patent down. So the success rate it depends a lot also on what time period you're looking at. For instance, before 1980, patents were very disfavored in the court system because they were treated like a monopoly. It's kind of a holdover back from the 20s era. Anti-monopolistic kind of stuff, and they were, like I said, very disfavored law, and those suits really didn't go very far. Now, after the 80s and more recently, it's been a lot easier to deal with patent lawsuits. They're a lot more likely to go through, but it seems like the pendulum's kind of starting to swing back the other way. And I know that that's a long way around to not answer your question, but that's kind of the way it's going in the field in general.
It just seems like there's probably a threshold in terms of profitability of a patent, you know, how much you make versus if you have any litigation. In a lot of cases, it's almost not worth filing a patent because of the trouble it can create for
right.
you downstream, unless it's a very profitable patent.
Right, and that's a very, very valid point. Typically, what you're looking at with a patent in particular is, in the high-tech area, you're looking for, I want to file a patent, I want to turn around and license it. I want to make money off of it that way. I don't actually want to sue anybody. Nobody wants to get into a patent war because it's expensive. So, you know, from that standpoint, the reason why you would file a patent more as an individual inventor is either in an attempt to try to sell it, or, which is kind of iffy, that's very difficult to do, or just as a kind of a scare tactic, you know, leave my product alone or I'm going to sue you and, you know, I can get lawyered up faster than you can. And so there's normally a lot of posturing with these things.
How much does it cost to file a patent in general? I know that's a wide variety of things.
Into the mic, please, since we're recording. I don't know.
How much does it cost to file a patent from the beginning of the process to the end on average? Because I know it'll be a wide variation.
Yeah. On average, for a small inventor, and as I said earlier, that distinction is important whether you're a small or a large entity. But for a small inventor, a small entity, you're usually looking at maybe anywhere from 8 to 10,000-ish ballpark. So it's pretty high. And I try to have this discussion with anybody who just calls me on the phone and asks, because I don't want anybody to get in and start on this process without realizing that it's going to take a long time and a lot of money. So this is by far the most expensive form of IP protection. I actually have another slide on this one. As I said, it's fairly expensive. Also, you got to remember the patent is a business investment. Excuse me. And typically, as I said, the inventors that are most successful that I know the patent was kind of icing on their cake. They actually were going out and they were selling the invention. That's where they made their money. And that's part of the good thing with the PTO taking forever to get back to you is once you file the patent, you want to go out and make some money so that you can start paying those fees whenever they come up. And if you're not making any money at that point, you can just let the whole thing drop and say forget it, because in 4 or 5 years you're going to know whether or not it's going to be worth it to you. Let me see. Another thing is patents last for 20 years. They're non-renewable. Unlike copyright that lasts 75 years from the date of death of the author, you know, patents have always been 20 years as far as I know. They used to be 17 years from the date of issuance as opposed to, now they're 20 years from the date of filing, but still roughly 20 years. Other thing to note is that only about 55% of applications issue as patents. Now this statistic was kind of hard to nail down. This is from the PTO. That was basically, they were saying 55% of the ones that it issued that year, because you're having a lot of patents that go back over and over and over again, so it's kind of hard to quantify. But the point being that the rejection rate is kind of high, which is why you have to be so technical and the application has to be so well prepared on the front end, because it's going to face a lot of scrutiny. Now, move on to trademark. Trademark's a little bit easier to handle, easier to swallow. The point of trademark is to indicate a product's origin. In this case, a registration gives federal protection. And with patents, the same thing. You're getting federal protection. Whereas with trademark, also, most states have some kind of state protection that happens automatically. If I start promoting myself under a certain business name, I have some rights under state law, typically. I know Mississippi does. I'm assuming Georgia does. Since I'm not a Georgia lawyer, I couldn't say. But normally, your trademark rights are a little more beefed up if you go with a federal registration. And really, the point of a trademark is to protect your consumer goodwill. Primarily, when you want to do this, is if you're putting advertising money out, you don't want somebody coming up and taking your name. And the best example I can think of this was something that actually happened in Jackson, Mississippi, just down from me. There was a large furniture store named Miskelly's. They put on the corner of this one street. Well, across the way, on the opposite corner, somebody else came up with a Howard Miskelly's and put right next door. So if you said, go down to Miskelly's at the corner because I bought this really cool item there, it was a question of which one are you talking about. And I noticed later that the bigger store bought up the smaller one to stop that problem from happening. But that's really what you're trying to prevent with a trademark. You don't want somebody taking off on that name. Now, getting back to kind of the game example. Again, I'm a big dork, so cattle racers are a moving experience because they're cows. The whole point of a trademark on this would be to protect that name so nobody else can come and make a copy of it or anything that's substantially similar. Now, one thing that needs to be discussed when you're talking about trademark, the way the law has handled this for whatever reason was to classify different levels of marks. If your trademark is descriptive down at the bottom, you can't. If you file a trademark application, they will allow it to register if you've been using it for 5 years. If it's generically descriptive, you can't ever register it because for reasons I'll get into later. If it's any of those first three categories, you're fine. Now, the categories are fanciful. I couldn't think of a game company that uses a fanciful one. Basically, it's a word that doesn't mean anything in and of itself, like Kodak. Kodak is just a camera company. There's no such word. Usually, you're looking at words with lots of X's and Z's in them. Exxon is another example. Arbitrary is when you have something that where the trade name has nothing to do with what you're using it for. PopCap games, because PopCap doesn't have anything to do with a game. Or any of the games they sell, as far as I'm aware. Suggestive is when your name suggests what it is you're doing. Super Smash Brothers, you're suggesting you've got this game where you've got people beating each other up. Descriptive, the name actually describes what it is you're doing. Dungeons and Dragons, you're playing a game where you're going through dungeons fighting dragons, roughly. I mean, you do a lot of other stuff, but that was at least the base concept. So that one is probably descriptive. And then you're generically descriptive, the game. Another Jackson thing, just because that's what I'm aware of, there's a group called the Ad Agency. And I know in my trademark class in law school, the professor used to make fun of them unmercifully for calling themselves that, because that they can never trademark that. Primarily because if someone else wants to advertise their services and the government was allow you to block off this generically descriptive term, then it would really prevent anyone from actually explaining what it is they are without infringing on your trademark. So they're real tight on that one. And like I said, on the descriptive, they just want you to use it for 5 years. Now, and I'm sure I've gone through that pretty quickly, so it's kind of hard to figure out exactly where those lines are. But a lot of it's really a judgment call, and it a lot of times comes down to the trademark examiner. But that's really your only major issue when you're trying to register trademarks. Now, let's look at the... Yes, sir.
So the game like Monopoly, could they trademark the name?
Yes, I would. Well, Monopoly is not going to be generically descriptive. It's going to be either descriptive or either going to be descriptive or suggestive. Well, even to that, it suggests that there's some kind of monopolistic stuff. It's probably going to be suggestive and issue straight away. But even if it's descriptive, as long as it's in use for 5 years, then you can get a trademark, which Monopoly has been.
I just wanted to point out for people who might be trying to think up their names that it's also relative to your industry. So Monopoly as a game can be very specific, okay, because a trademark's only going to survive there. It's not a general term. And another, for instance, for that would be Domino's Pizza and Domino's Sugar are both trademarks. And one sued the other, and there was a settlement because nobody goes out to buy sugar that tastes like pizza. So there's a common different brand awareness between the consumer.
Very, very valid point. Another example would be Delta Faucets and Delta Airlines. You can have the same trademark in different industries, just so long... Right. Yes, ma'am.
Explain again, because I kind of got lost in that. You said that if you're using a name for 5 years, you automatically get your trademark?
Now, if you're using a descriptive name, basically if an examiner would look at it and say, this name is descriptive, it describes what it is you're doing, then if you go to file a trademark on that, then the examiner will say, you know, this needs to be in continuous use for 5 years before I'll let you have it. But again, if you just start using it, you probably have some state rights anyway. You would use it for 5 years, then you file your trademark application. But then it's pretty well automatic, yeah, unless something else comes up. Basically, unless somebody else is using it is the other issue, and they got a trademark application in before you did. But getting over to our cattle raisers example, I would say that cattle raisers is probably suggestive. And so I think it's probably okay to trademark as long as no one else is already using something that's almost the same. And this, whenever you get there, the trademark examiner will do a novelty, or not a novelty, they'll do a search anyway to see who else is using anything similar. If there's anything real similar, they'll reject you. If not, they'll let it through. Now, here are some examples of some games that have been trademarked. You got Magic the Gathering and Dungeons & Dragons, both TSR games. Actually, Wizards of the Coast, and then now Hasbro, I think. World of Munchkin. Actually, I think it's the Munchkin term that they trademarked. That's Peter Jackson Games. And then PopCap, as I mentioned earlier. And from a practical standpoint, trademark registration is a lot cheaper than going with a patent. Some automatic rights exist as well, which is also good. There are a lot fewer hurdles to go through with a trademark application. Either it is or it isn't. It's a lot less of a gray area. PTO responds in about a year on a trademark application as opposed to the 4 or 5 years you're looking at with patent. Also, it's perpetually renewable, so you can keep a trademark as long as you keep filing your renewals every, I think it's the first one's at 5 years, and after that every 10 years. You can keep it. As long as you keep using it, you can keep it. So you're not bound to that 20-year issue you've got with the patent. So for a company, really, trademark, I think, is a better buy than patent. It's just, you know, you might want to use multiple different types of protection on depending on what you're trying to do. Just other trademark issues for your information. You'll see a lot of marks that they'll write TM or SM. What that means is TM means that that company is using that mark as a trademark. They're just telling the public, this is a trademark, don't mess with it. And normally the reason why you would do that is if you think it's descriptive and you want to use it for 5 years for purposes of filing a trademark application, and you're just, like I said, putting the public on notice. SM just means service mark. The only difference there being that trademark is for goods, service mark is for services. You know, Bob's Plumbing is going to be a service mark, whereas Bob's Electronic or Electronic Parts is going to be a trademark. Bad example, but okay. And then the registered R, the circle R, that just means a mark has been registered with the Patent and Trademark Office. So you get the right to put that on there once your trademark issues if you file a trademark with them. So then the question becomes, why would you apply for a trademark registration? Now, as I said earlier, if you don't file a trademark registration, you start using that name, you may have some rights under state law, but that really depends on the state you happen to be in. The good thing about registering with the PTO is it gives you a nationwide right to stop any subsequent users. And the good thing, too, is with a state claim, it prevents people from actively trying to steal your goodwill. If you've got a federal mark, if anyone even accidentally uses your name, like if I'm over here and I've got a business running in Atlanta, somebody in LA who doesn't know about me starts running a business, they call it the same thing. If I find out and I have a federal mark, I can actually make them stop. Even if they didn't know about it, there was no ill will about it. So you get a lot broader protection in that sense. And the date when you can start doing that is when you file that federal trademark. If you're, if I start using it and then someone else starts using it, we're using it together for a while, then I file the federal trademark. I can't stop them, but I can kind of bound the area where they can practice. So if they try to move out of their area, then my federal trademark kicks in. So really the earlier you can file one, the better for that reason. Now, kind of moving on. Yes, sir.
And I'm not sure whether this was under trademark. Some years ago when the Olympics were in Atlanta, there was a notorious case about an Olympic pizza house or something like that, and the Olympic Committee was suing them for using the name Olympic, even though they had been around for 20 years. I don't know if you had any knowledge of that case or what happened there.
I don't have any knowledge of that case in particular, just because, again, I practice in Mississippi and not over here. But, I think that would be a tough fight if somebody brought that to me and asked me to do something about it, just because, Olympic as to pizza is probably an arbitrary name anyway.
Some kind of Greek, it was a Greek restaurant or something like that, like that theme. But anyway, I just wondered.
I don't know where that went. I'm just thinking that it sounds to me like that would be a tough case to prosecute the pizza place for. Well, again, because there's not, I doubt the, unless the Olympic Commission or whoever runs the Olympics has some kind of a mark on that name, maybe.
That's apparently the
part of the basis for that. Probably. I would assume so. Any other questions before we move on to copyright? Okay, and we can always revisit any ground at the end. I know I'm moving kind of quickly, but all right, so copyright. This is a right that is granted by the federal government. And I think some state governments might, but it really falls under the Constitution. A copyright protects an original work of authorship fixed in tangible medium. That's the textbook legal definition pulled out of case law. Basically, that means that you're artwork has to be somehow original and new compared to other people's. And it also has to be actually fixed. It can't be something in your head. You've got to either, it's got to be on a piece of paper, got to be instantiated on a disc, that sort of thing. This copyright covers form, not function, whereas patent covers function, not form. So they're kind of mutually exclusive. Is that a question? Okay, sorry. Now, we'll pull up copyright as it applies to our cattle racer example. Here we have just some graphics put together to kind of show how a card would work. That would probably be copyrightable. Now, procedural differences between this and the trademark and patent stuff we've been talking about. This is filed through the Library of Congress. Actually, the Copyright Office is kind of a subset of the Library of Congress, as opposed to the Patent and Trademark Office. So completely different procedure, and with the Copyright Office, they don't really do a novelty search to see if anyone's done it before. They really kind of give you a pass on originality. they almost rubber stamp things. So as long as you fill out your form right, your copyright's probably going to go through. So the filing fees to them are lower because they don't have to pay their examiners to do these in-depth searches. Also, your fees to your attorneys are going to be lower because with them, you're basically filing a form and just answering any questions if they come up. So copyright, you're going to get, is like I said, one of the cheapest, although except for trade secret, we'll get to later. But and the other good thing with copyright is if you are an author or anything that falls under copyright, your copyright lasts from 75 years after the date you die. Thank Walt Disney for that. We had a lot of angst last night for that particular length of copyright protection. But it's useful. Yes, sir.
So since there's just been so many written works, I'm a writer myself.
Right.
And I'll give an example directly from me. I wrote a story that was virtually identical to a story written in the 50s, which I had never heard of. It was only when someone else read the story that they said, oh, it's very similar to this story, and I read it, and 90% it was exactly the same story. Now, if the Library of Congress is basically, if they're basically rubber stamping copyrights, is it possible that this original author in the 50s has a copyrighted story, and then I submit my story for a copyright, it gets a copyright, but they're virtually identical stories?
Yes, that's very possible. And with the, I guess it's a different philosophy between the two different offices. The Patent and Trademark Office, they have the philosophy of they're trying to guard the public domain and keep you from pulling things in that you shouldn't have protection in. So they're going to try to err on the side of, I'm not giving it to you. Whereas the Copyright Office, their thing is, our job is to record things. We're a library. So they issue stuff with the idea of the court system will sort it out. If you've got two competing copyrights, you guys will sue each other and you'll deal with it and it's not a problem. And that's kind of the way that ends up working.
Further his question. Pre-1967 stuff, copyrights, 76. Is still 75 years, or was it 20?
I don't believe it was 20. I believe it was 50. And I'm a little rusty on my law pre-76, so I don't deal with that a lot. The law really, they completely rewrote copyright at that point. Also, the other issue, too, is it used to be pre-76 that if you published your works and didn't file a copyright registration, it fell into the public domain. So you had to be a lot more proactive. Now you can always go back and refile later. There's really no hurry on it. In fact, there have been a couple of litigation suits that I've been involved with where the artist was ready to sue, realized they hadn't filed the copyright registration, went back and did it, and as long as we filed it before we sued, it was fine. So you can be a lot more loose with copyright now than you could have pre-76. Yes, sir.
Isn't there some level of copyright that's automatic? I know people run into this with taking photos.
Right.
I take one of me at my first birthday that my grandmother took, take it to the local photo shop and ask for a copy to be made, and they refuse to do it because I don't have a copyright release. Obviously, I'm in the picture as one. I didn't take the picture. And I say, well, my grandmother's dead. And they say, well, you're tough. You got to wait 75 years, and then you can, get a copy.
Right. And you do. There are some basic rights that attach just by virtue of creating something. They're automatic. Really, the difference between filing a registration and not is, A, if you can't really sue on something until you file a registration. So you have these theoretical rights that you can't really enforce. Also, your remedies are a lot better. I know, and some of you may have been in here for this discussion last night, that there's this whole idea of statutory damages that you get under law, where there's just a set amount, and statutory damages are usually pretty high, versus you can also get profits. Well, if you haven't filed a copyright registration, you can only get profits. You don't have that statutory option. So that's honestly the main reason why you'd want to go on and file it early rather than later. Yes, ma'am.
TM trademark and the R circle for the registration, and does that only apply to products or does that also apply to written material?
The difference being that with TM, typically what that technically means is the person has not filed a trademark registration yet. With registered R, the circle R means that they have filed an application with a trademark office and it's issued at the other end. Now, I've noticed sometimes with trademarks, people will leave that TM on even after it's registered. One of the examples was that Magic the Gathering card. It has TM written on it. I know for a fact it's been registered with the PTO because I looked it up. But I can see from their standpoint, they will probably never change that card because they want all the backs of all their cards to look the same. And, you know, it might mess with the game mechanics if you change it. But that's really the technical difference there, and you probably should update to an R once you file a trademark registration.
So a when TM versus the R is like patent pending.
Right. That's a very good analogy. Yes, sir.
Is there a requirement that you put the R if you're registered? You don't have to. You just want people to know, right?
It's not actually, I believe with trademark there is. If you don't put your R stamp, I know it is for patent. I'm almost sure positive it is for that as well. If you don't put that on there, you can lose your rights after a while.
Okay. That's an issue of not defending it if you have
right.
to defend it.
Yeah, because basically the idea is if you've got a trademark, at least, you know, legally speaking, you should let others know that that's out there. You should patrol, and if you don't, then you lose your rights.
So for TM, do you have to have filed for a trademark in order to use it?
No. For TM, that just means I'm letting the public know I'm going to be using this mark, and that how much protection you get is really, like I said, up to whatever that state's rights are, whatever state you're in.
I noticed for a lot of CCGs and TCGs, when they do get their trademark registration, they'll put that on the packaging of the cards, and they'll put them on the rule books, and even on the front face of the cards.
Right.
But they will not put it on the back.
Right, and that's a good way to deal with that particular issue, because you want to keep that trademark, you want to put the public on notice, although it's kind of a non-issue, because I'm probably the only one on the planet that actually looks for these things. So, you know, you've got a bunch of dorky lawyers that are looking for them. Nobody else knows the difference or cares, but just to meet with the PTO's requirements, you really do want to put those on there. Okay, let's see. Any other questions before we kind of move on? All right. As I said, I think we've covered everything here. Practical considerations on your copyright. As we mentioned, some of those rights exist even without registration. They just immediately pop into being as soon as you create whatever the copyrighted work is. Lasts for 75 years after the creator's death, which to me, honestly, I feel like is a very, very long time. I think it's a little overkill, but it is what it is. The overall cost is a lot lower than with either patent or trademark because you're not having those filing costs. And you can use Circle C once you've registered it.
So, regarding the 75 years after the creator's death, is it possible to buy the rights to a creator's work and extend them afterwards? And I'm only going to give a very specific example of H.P. Lovecraft, if I'm saying it right. Chaosium, Inc. owns the rights to H.P.
Right.
Lovecraft's work, even though it's been 75 years since he's died.
Yeah, theoretically, it should go into the public domain 75 years after death, but I know there's some jinky things with the laws that are pre-76, and that's a lot of the old stuff, again, works under a different system. I think those are renewable to a certain extent. Anything that would be filed now would not be renewable. But there's also other issues of you can take some stuff and you can kind of repackage it and you can file on the newer version. So there are a lot of little things you can do to kind of try to squeak a little bit extra out of there. But, that being the very fishy answer on that. But like I said, theoretically, you shouldn't be able to. You can try. Well, it's kind of like with patent. Those last for 20 years. One of the things the drug companies will do is they will file a patent on the drug, and then in 19 years, they'll file a patent on the process for making the drug. So they kind of double their patent length by doing that, even though they probably shouldn't. But
Johnson & Johnson patented or did something with the drug Retin-A, tretinoin, and it came out, I don't know, it probably came out in the early 70s, and at some point its patent life was running down.
Right.
So they repatented it, and they did it in a delivery system. Mm-hmm. They put it they put it into a little tube with a plunger, with a way of plunging it out, and with that they extended it further. Then they did it again with another delivery system, and of course they did it by changing the concentration a little bit.
Right.
And then I think they did it one more time. I mean, these changes made no sense in any real life, any real world, no significance. But it managed to extend their and patent or whatever they had.
Yeah, there are some games you can play with that, and really, the law has been trying to kind of stop some of that. I remember there was an example where one of my professors back in law school using where there was a patent for, I forget what. Anyway, there was a patent for a very basic technology that they just kept making improvements to, and they kept the patent rolling. As long as they kept the patent up in the air and it never finally issued, they could keep adding on to it. And they did this for years. And that's part of the reason why now when you file a patent, you get 20 years from the date you first file it. So once you're up to about 15, 16 years, then you can't just keep it in the office and keep rolling. Eventually it's going to run out, even if you're doing that. As far as changing the delivery method, the practical of that is if another company came along and made the exact same drug and used a different delivery method, it wouldn't be infringing their patent. So what you end up with is a lot of reading the patents extremely closely and a lot of nitpicking and a lot of lawyers arguing over whether something infringes or not. And just as a practical matter. Yeah. Yes, sir.
With regards to medication, mm-hmm. Isn't it down to like 7 or 12 years on medication before generics can be introduced, before the formula method is unveiled from the patent?
If there is any kind of standard that's completely separate from patent law, I mean, patent does last for 20 years. Now, it could be, and what it probably is in that case is because the pendency time with a PTO is so long, they probably filed it, and then it took them 6 or 7 years to actually get their patent. Then they hit the market with it, so then you're only looking at 13 years or so.
Well, part of it, I think, though, is that there's FDA regulation now that actually limits the amount of time that the patent can go through, because it's something about monopoly and market competition, and then also of efficacy of use of a medication. That they start pulling, the FDA is starting to review medications again after it's been on the market for like 5 to 10 years, is used as a broader market study.
And I'll just say that is possible. I'm not familiar with the FDA regulations because, honestly, my background is in electrical and computer engineering, so I don't really do much biotech. Actually, I don't do any biotech work because I wouldn't understand how the technology works well enough to do it. So it's not really something I run into a lot, but that may be the case. I'm really not sure. Yes, sir.
Maybe kind of an obscure question, but I work with a group that produces data visualizations for a government agency, and all their data visualizations are technically public domain because they're created with the taxpayer dollars. We've encountered cases where people take our material, this public domain, mm-hmm. and use it to promote their group or their business or something like that, in some cases going so far as implying that they actually produce the original product.
Mm-hmm.
We're not sure if they're actually selling some of this stuff. They're using it as a promotional tool, but we're a little uncomfortable with that. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of issue that could be done with that.
I can't really think of much, just because if it's in the public domain, anybody is free to use it. Now, you know, if their marketing implies that they're creating it, I mean, it could be a false advertising claim, but there's not a whole lot there, I don't think. But, you know, I would have to research it a lot more to really be able to say one way or another. Let's see. All right, so we want to, going back to copyright, looking at our cattle racer example, these images are hypothetically original. I mean, basically, my wife did this for me. She's a fantastic graphic designer. She just took an image of a cow and kind of inverted it, and, you know, so it's, but we can call that original. The image is fixed in a tangible medium because it's on a card, so therefore, to the extent that it's original, then it is copyrightable. So, and I think we probably already covered some of this, but that's the why would you file a copyright registration? because you can get those statutory damages, which range for standard infringement anywhere from $750 to, I think, $75,000, excuse me. And then for willful infringement, $750 to $150,000. So it gives you kind of a club to beat somebody over the head with if they're infringing your copyright. Another thing that I know is important, especially for artists, is if you have a copyright registration before the other person infringes, you can actually sue and make them destroy any infringing articles. For instance, my firm represents a painter, and someone was infringing her copyright, and her main concern is, you know, I do fine art, I sell my works for a lot of money, and these are cheap knockoffs, and this tarnishes my good name. So that's the reason why she really, really wanted those infringing articles destroyed and those not on the market. So that's one of the things you can do with a registration. And again, you have to have one before you file any lawsuit in federal court. It's kind of your gateway just into the courthouse. Final point of IP protection, trade secret. I don't do a whole lot with this personally, but it's out there. Any information that's kept secret and gives a company a competitive advantage is technically a trade secret. This is the only kind of intellectual property that doesn't require any kind of registration at all. It just, it is, just by virtue of having it. Kinds of things that would fall under trade secret or customer list, any kind of distribution channels, manufacturing strategies, any, if you have a specific way of printing something. And those rights are exclusively governed by state law, so I can't say, again, a whole lot in Georgia because I don't practice here, but that's always an option. The main thing is with trade secret, the item must actually be kept secret. The best example of trade secret that I can think of is the formula for the drink Coca-Cola. Nobody knows except for like probably two or three guys that work at Coca-Cola how to actually mix the stuff up. And they keep it a very, very well guarded secret for that reason. And if anyone were to steal that formula and use it, then they would be violating their trade secret and Coca-Cola could come sue them. The best way to deal with trade secret issues is you just, anytime you have to let that information out, you make whoever you're talking to sign a non-disclosure agreement. They agree to keep it secret, so as long as everyone involved is keeping it secret, it's secret. The rights last as long as the secret does.
Yes, so if somebody at Coke decides to talk, mm-hmm. that doesn't necessarily mean that somebody wouldn't be violating their trade secret because they did due diligence to try to prevent it.
Right. That wouldn't get rid of their trade secret. Now, if it became public knowledge as to some of that, it might lose its trade secret status just if they were talking loudly enough people heard it. But then whoever was talking would be liable for any damage that resulted from that. Because, again, whoever's running off with the secret, that issue is between Coca-Cola and that person. But if a third party picks it up that, you know, and runs with it, they didn't really have any, innocently anyway, they didn't have any knowledge, it's not their fault. Yes, ma'am.
What happens if you come up with a formulation for a cola product and it just so happens, coincidentally, to be exactly the same as the Coca-Cola one? What happens?
That's fine. Now, Coke would probably come knocking on my door anyway, and because they would assume I stole it. But if it just so happens to be the same thing, I haven't done anything wrong. I haven't violated any of their rights because I didn't steal their secret. I came up with it independently. So that theoretically should be okay, but I'm sure you'd get into litigation over that anyway. And actually, as I recall, a group tried to steal the Coke formula and pass it over to Pepsi, and Pepsi basically turned them in. So they were like, we don't want any part of this. So, nor should you. But, like I said, the great thing about trade secrets is the rights are perpetual as long as that's kept secret. Coke's been secret for years.
So if somebody steals Colonel Sanders' secret recipe, mm-hmm. the 11 different herbs and spices,
right,
and the Coke recipe, and publishes it, does that destroy the secrecy?
I think it might. That would be real tough. Now, as far as I know, that both companies would be very upset, and whoever published it would they would bury them under the ground. But I think there's a strong possibility it would. Yes, Dr. Evil would get. Yep. said, I think that there's a very strong possibility that would happen. It would really depend on, probably depend on the how widely it was circulated and that sort of thing, but that's a possibility. And again, the thing with a trade secret is you can sue if somebody else acquires the secret illicitly, like I said, in that scenario. So kind of moving back to our cattle racer example, things that might be trade secrets, say if we have an email list of customers who like to buy our products, that would be something that we wouldn't want getting out. We would want to keep that, and if anyone stole our customer list, we would go sue them. Any kind of a retailer list as far as stores that, that will buy products of this type, even though someone else might can recreate the that information themselves, it's still, if they take it from us, as we were talking about earlier, then that's a violation of trade secret, manufacturing printing methods, as we've mentioned.
Yes, sir. Can the government require require a company to reveal a trade secret if it were to come up in litigation?
I guess the quick and the non-answer to that is the government can probably require whatever they want to because they're the government. But realistically, government is usually, at least in the past, been taking kind of a hands-off approach to private market and commerce. Normally, the way this would be handled is if there was litigation over it, everything that had to do with the trade secret would be put under seal so that the people involved could hear about it, but all those documents would be sealed up and wouldn't be made public record to keep that secret secret. So let's kind of compare trade secret to patent, because that's kind of important. Your patent requires disclosure. For you to get a patent, you have to make that knowledge public of how this works and why. With a trade secret, you're required to keep it secret. So the two don't really work together typically well. Patent lasts for 20 years. Trade secret is perpetual. Patent law is national, but trade secret depends on jurisdiction, whether what state you're in. So there's kind of an interplay there, and there's a decision if you have something that can't be reverse engineered, which is a stretch from a technological standpoint, but if you have a product that can't be reverse engineered, like Coca-Cola, then it's a very valid question of whether I want to take the trade secret route or the patent route. And that's just something to consider if it comes up. But again, when you have something like List, it's not much to think about, but just as far as the product itself. So in summary, each type of protection has a different use. And you can apply those protections to the same situation in different ways. Like you can copyright what's on a card, and you patent the mechanism for using the card, and you trademark the name you stick on the card. Many businesses benefit from creating a strategically designed IP portfolio to cover the same product in 10 different ways so they can handle anything that might come up. So basically, just as a general rule, you patent the function, you copyright the look, and you trademark the brand, and you protect any secrets that happen to come up. So any other questions?
So let's say I want to use some material from the 1930s or 1940s, and I'm not sure that it's covered by copyright, and it's not listed on the copyright.org website.
Right.
Is there anything that I could do beyond that to verify whether or not it's copyrighted?
There's really not. What I would typically do, and again, since my wife is a graphic designer, that issue comes up a lot in our house. It's fun, she gets free legal advice. But what we typically end up doing, you check out your copyrightdeath.org, see if it's listed anywhere as being public domain. My rule of thumb is if the author has been dead for 75 years, I'm not too worried about it unless I specifically know, like with, I believe it was Lovecraft we were talking about earlier, unless I specifically know there's some group that's really patrolling it. And it also really comes down to just a judgment call, because, and we've had these discussions around our office every now and again because we do a lot of entertainment law, whenever we're using something and we go, okay, is this a group that, if there's like, for instance, the Elvis estate, we happen to know that they're very aggressive about patrolling Elvis's copyrights. So we have a strict hands-off policy. We don't touch them. Now, if there's an estate that we don't know if there's an organized estate or if there's anybody out there, then just as a practical matter, we just kind of weigh what's the likelihood of getting sued on this, and you know, how to what extent can we honestly, truly plead ignorance of whether or not it's copyrighted. And so that's kind of what you have to go with. And anything that's kind of suspect, if you're risk averse, don't do it. If you're not risk averse, then I guess kind of try to keep the circulation to a minimum. That way, if it comes up, you can just say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know," and pull it. Any other questions?
You said your background's in electrical engineering.
Yes, sir.
Did you complete an electrical engineering degree, and where from?
Computer engineering from Mississippi State University.
Cool.
In fact, to be a patent attorney, you have to get either a degree in engineering, one of the base sciences, or you can actually get there if you have enough credits and compile it together, but it's like a long list. So most of your patent attorneys are, like I said, either engineers or scientists, and a lot actually, I didn't, a lot actually work in the field before they come back as patent attorneys. I went straight through, but for what it's worth. Any other questions? Well, I guess not. Thank you all for coming. Anybody who didn't get a bookmark earlier, feel free. I'll be passing these around.
Hey, Greg.